So, whilst Rachel attaches microphones and so on, Rachel Cooper, who's kindly organised today's proceedings, senior lecturer in philosophy here in Lancaster, author of a number of books on the philosophy of psychiatry, and the main coming from a sort of philosophy of science. I often think, Rachel and I both went to the same department in Cambridge, and with her the training worked. Insofar as she became a philosopher of science who can do history as well and draw on that, whereas for me, it was all less successful. So I'm always impressed by the empirical work behind Rachel's philosophy of science. But perhaps her most relevant book for this workshop is, in fact, the rather old book now, Classifying Madness, which is perhaps the most of the metaphysically charged or metaphysically implicated book. So, Rachel, please.
Okay, well, thank you very much. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to compare some of the claims that are made and the assumptions of two books. So my book, Classifying Madness, which looks at conceptual problems to do with classification in psychiatry, and Peter's book, which he's talked about a bit already. So I'm embarrassed about my book for two main reasons. So one is it's got a pretty bad cover, which is like, you know, a big, I was pretty upset when I saw that. I was like, and the other thing is it's embarrassingly expensive. But I'm going to tell you what it says so you don't need to read it. If anyone does want a copy, I have some free electronic copies that you can have. So Peter and I, in our work, have addressed many of the same kinds of issues, stuff to do with classification, of psychopathology. Peter's written a lot on what it means to say that a disorder's real. But lots of our interests overlap. And I think one of the things that interests me is that maybe concrete claims is the wrong word, but when it comes to particular claims about what classification should be like, Peter and I almost always agree. So we agree that there are going to be multiple pretty good classifications, and that which one you choose in any particular context depends on what you're trying to do in that context and on your values. So when it comes to claims like that, Peter and I think almost always agree with each other, and yet we develop our work within radically different metaphysical and epistemic frameworks. So we have radically different ideas about roughly what the world is like and how we can find out about it. And I guess for me that raises the question of whether the metaphysical frameworks do any real work. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a little bit about the framework I employ in my book. Then I'm going to compare that with some of the claims that Peter makes and pick on Peter a bit. I guess the aim isn't so much to argue that Peter's wrong about various things, but just to show how there are quite deep disagreements, and how if we could get by without employing the kind of metaphysically heavyweight claims that we do, I think it would be a good thing. And I'm going to make some tentative suggestions as to how that might be possible. So, the framework I employ in my book, I haven't got a name for, but you could call it common sense realism. You could even call it naive realism if you wanted. So I think I believe many things that all reasonable people should think. So I think there's a world. I think it has things in it, like tables, chairs. I think it has people in it. Now, more controversially, I think the world has a natural and observer-independent structure. I'm going to say a little bit more about what that might be like. I think that science isn't hopeless, but is pretty hard. So I think that if we try hard, we can sometimes find out about the world, but it can be difficult. Now for a bit more about the idea that the world has a natural structure. So the thought is that there are some entities in the world that are just naturally similar to each other. So this is a part of a beetle collection from a natural history museum. I don't know much about these beetles, but the thought is that the brown beetles, the big brown ones, are all pretty similar to each other. And I think that's because they possess similar properties and they can be expected to behave similarly. So the thought is that things in the world come in groups quite often of things that are naturally similar to each other. They have similar properties. And so like if you chopped up one of these beetles, I'd expect them all to look kind of similar inside, them all to eat the same sort of stuff and so on. And then the thought is that it's a good idea, if we want to understand the world, to look for these natural kinds. So that's the basic idea. Now there's a few complications. So the first complication is that I'd want to have a non-essentialist account of kinds. Essentialism's been discussed a bit already. So talk of natural kinds often gets linked with talk of essentialism or essences. As with almost all philosophical terms, when people talk about essences, they often mean different things. I take it to be the view that members of a natural kind have some particular property which is necessary and sufficient for making them the kind of thing that they are. As John was saying, I think that there are some areas where it might be right to think that things have essences. So Peter was saying there are complications in chemistry, but still that or like fundamental physics say, it looks to me like there might be domains in the world where it does happen to be the case that all members of a kind are similar because they have some underlying property that they all have in common. But I think it just so happens to be plausibly an empirical fact that when it comes to biological kinds and also kinds of mental disorder, that it looks like they don't have essential properties. So when it comes to biological species, as a matter of empirical fact, it looks like there's a hell of a lot of variation. So things vary both when it comes to observable physical properties and also when it comes to genetic properties. And so I think we need a non-essentialist account of kinds. There's a number of non-essentialist accounts of kinds that are kind of on the philosophical market. They differ in various ways, but I don't think it matters too much which one you go for. The basic idea is that you're going to have an account of kinds which says that members of a kind can be expected to behave similarly because they have properties that are similar to each other. Now, the account that I particularly like is an account that's been developed by the philosopher of biology, John Dupré. He calls his position promiscuous realism. He says if it were possible to map individual organisms on a multidimensional quality space, we'd find numerous clusters or bumps. In some parts of biology, these clusters will be almost entirely discrete. And his idea is that these clusters are what natural kinds are. Now, I haven't managed to draw very many dimensions for you. I've drawn two. You have to imagine there's a lot more. The idea is that you plot entities in this space. When they're close together, that indicates that they're similar to each other. And this is a realist position, but it's a promiscuous realist position. So the idea is that the world has a natural structure, but it's pretty complicated. And so you can generate multiple classifications out of this kind of picture. So when I say the world's pretty complicated, I think it's pretty complicated in some domains, like biology, psychopathology. There might be some domains where it's not all that complicated. So how can you generate multiple classifications? Well, there's two main ways to do it. You might go in for a kind of broad brushstrokes classification or something that gives you a finer level of description. So for certain types of project, it might be enough to know whether something's a mammal or a fish, say. For other projects, you might want to classify down to particular subspecies or whatever. So that's one way you can get different classifications. The other way is that you can focus in on particular dimensions for different purposes. So John Dupré talks about how when it comes to the biological sciences, for certain types of question, genetic properties are the most important. So you could have a classification that just focuses on those. For other types of question, ecological properties might be more interesting, and then you can focus on those. So the basic idea is that the world's pretty complicated, and you can get multiple classifications that are good for different purposes, exploring different types of question by focusing on particular features of the real structure. And so the thought in my book is that something like that kind of model will plausibly be the right one for thinking about psychopathology as well, as another domain that is pretty complicated. Okay, so that's the first complication. I want an account of kinds but a non-essentialist account. Second complication has to do with the question of whether natural kinds need to have gaps. So there is, in the tradition, when people talk about natural kinds, quite a lot of people make a big thing of this idea that you ought to have kind of natural boundaries, you know, gaps between one kind or another. I don't think that whether there are gaps or not matters terribly much. So I think that there are areas of science that show us that kinds that vary continuously can be just as good for supporting inductive inferences as more categorical classifications. So the picture I've got for you, you can't see it very well, but it's a little diagram. It shows some of the physical properties of different types of alloy. Alloys are interesting for me because they vary continuously, because you can blend different proportions of different metals. And yet, as long as you know what the composition of an alloy is, you can predict what the chemical properties of a particular bit of alloy are going to be. So the key point for me is that if we're interested in predicting how things are going to behave, it's the similarities between entities that do the work, not whether there are any gaps. So if it's the case that depression merges into anxiety, say, I don't think that matters too much. Still, if you knew where someone was on that kind of varying dimension, you'd be able to predict that they behave similarly to other people in the same kind of area of that space. Third complication, values. So when it comes to mental disorders, I think we should think that something's only a disorder if it's harmful. And so as a consequence of that claim, I think that the big category, the umbrella category of disorder, isn't a natural kind. Rather, it collects together a rather motley assortment of conditions that happen to cause people problems. And so I think that the big umbrella category disorder isn't a natural kind. But I think that particular types of condition that are often disorders that often cause people problems can still be natural kinds. So the analogy I develop is one with weeds. So weeds, I don't know how you define weeds, but it's going to be a value-laden definition. Weeds are going to be like plants that you don't like or something. And you can argue on over whether any particular type of plant's a weed or not. You could argue whether daisies are weeds or wildflowers. But still, the types of plant that are typically considered weeds, I think, can be natural kinds. Okay, so those are the complications. And then the point of the weed analogy is I think that you can think of mental disorders similarly. So in the book I say that the claim that schizophrenia is a disorder is in part a value judgment, but it might well be the case that schizophrenia and depression are natural kinds. Now, those are embarrassingly poor examples because it seems likely that schizophrenia and depression are quite heterogeneous, but still there might be subtypes that might be natural kinds. You get the basic idea. So that's the picture. I think it's worth noting that there are other people who've written in the philosophy of psychiatry within a realist kind of framework who think very similar things. So Laurie Resnick in The Nature of Disease, Dominic Murthy in his book as well. I think they have very similar pictures of how things might kind of fit together. Okay, so that was what I think. Now, for comparing my claims with Peter's. So, as I mentioned, I think Peter and I agree on many, many particular claims. So we agree that in psychiatry there will be a multiplicity of pretty good classifications. We agree that which classification is best depends on the context and on values. We agree, I think, that a good classification is going to support inductions. We agree that some conditions are likely vague, some dimensional, but that isn't the end of the world, that you could still employ categories like that. We also agree that cases of a good category have got to be similar in weight, but that needn't be cashed out in neurobiological terms. It might be at some other level. So we agree on lots of stuff, but we don't agree on our overall frameworks. So Peter's a pragmatist. Now, in his book, quite a lot of the book is taken up with setting out the pragmatist framework. So more than half the book sets out the framework. And in part, I think that Peter's framework is partly offering methodological advice. So quite a lot of it has to do with how we might be clear if we're trying to make claims in philosophy of psychiatry. And that those claims, I think, are useful, and I can take them on board. I think at that level, Peter's right. But when it comes to the metaphysical and epistemological framework, there are points where I disagree with him. I'm going to highlight two points where I disagree with Peter. Now, the point isn't so much that I think I'm right and he's wrong. The point is that these are deep disagreements that are very hard to resolve. So the first point of disagreement concerns the theory of truth. So Peter adopts a coherentist position. So I take it that the basic idea is that a claim is true if it coheres with some set of claims. So I take it the set of claims it's supposed to cohere with is going to be something like what the scientific community believes or something like that. The first thing I want to say is that this is a minority account of truth. And I know that because Philosophical Papers did a handy survey a few years ago. And so Peter comes out as an epistemic person, and there's not many other philosophers who would go for that. So most philosophers, when they're asked, would go for a correspondence account or a deflationist account. So a correspondence account, Peter's mentioned already, a correspondence person says a claim is true if it corresponds to the facts. And as Peter notes, what exactly corresponds with the facts is a pretty obscure notion. A deflationist account just says, well, if something's true, if it's true, and that's that. but those are some of the alternatives. To say a little bit more about Peter's coherentist account, I first of all want to suggest that it hasn't, I think, got some of the advantages he claims it has, and then I'm going to highlight one potential difficulty. So Peter worries that correspondence theories sometimes give the impression that in knowing what is really there, we get beyond evidence and experience. And coherence, in contrast, works from within experience. So I think you've got in Peter's work this idea that it's a good idea to have an account of truth that is somehow accessible potentially to human understanding. You don't want to make claims about something that transcends what we could ever find out about. Now, I worry that if you think that something is true, if it coheres with what the scientific community thinks, then that's also something that's inaccessible to an individual knower. Yeah? So scientists believe lots of stuff. Lots of it is really hard. Even to understand what it is they're going on about, let alone figuring out whether it all fits together or not. So I worry that coherence isn't all that accessible either. Now, for the potential problem, I think, so if you adopt a coherence account of truth, that pushes you to have a non-bivalent logic. So most philosophers would employ a classical account of logic on which everything is true or false. You might not know what it is, but it's going to be one or the other. Whereas Peter has a view where truth can't transcend what people can potentially find out. So he tells us, for example, that what Conan Doyle ate and drank on the day he finished The Adventure of the Empty House was a fact once, although it's likely no longer even a potential fact because it's not publicly ascertainable. So I take it that there is, if you say, oh, Conan Doyle ate Weetabix, yeah, that's neither going to be true nor false.
False.
Okay, porridge. Yeah. Now, so you're going to have a different type of logic. And whether that's a problem or not, I think is unclear, but it might be. So there's an ongoing debate. So Timothy Williamson thinks that it is absurd to go for a non-bivalent logic. Other people disagree with him. My point is that that's a difficult debate. That is like deep and dark stuff that's hard to resolve. Second disagreement. I think you can see if you say, ask the question, well, why is it that some kinds support inductive inferences? So I would say, well, it's because members of the kind possess similar properties. Properties are real features of the world that determine how things are behave. And Peter will point out that that's a pretty rubbish answer, which I think is fair enough. So it is, it's an admittedly obscure response, but the idea is that it's something about the nature of the world that means that there are certain kinds that support inductive inferences. Whereas Peter's answer is quite different. So if you ask Peter, he cites Nelson Goodman, and Nelson Goodman employs the notion of entrenchment. Exactly what entrenchment is again quite obscure, I think, but it has something to do with what a human community has habitually done in the past. So I think in Goodman you do have this idea that we happen to employ predicates like blue and green, and I think it's left an open possibility that there might have been other gangs of people, or it was a possibility that people could have gone about things quite differently. So for Goodman, it's not straightforwardly to do with the way the world is, that certain properties are kind of out there and will support inductions. It also has to do with the way people have done things as well. Now, I think what we can see here is that these metaphysical disagreements are hard to resolve. So these are difficult questions, and I think it illustrates how it would be better if we could have reached our conclusions without employing all this metaphysical stuff. And so the question is, well, could we have done that? And my tentative suggestion, though I'll be pleased to hear what you think about this and what Peter thinks about this, is we probably could. So I think that when it comes, concrete claims is probably the wrong word, but when it comes to specific claims we make about psychiatry or clinical psychology, as I said, we almost always agree. And I think when it comes to those claims, we could have made them without employing the metaphysical apparatus that we employ. I think quite often the way we could have made them without kind of going metaphysical is by making apt comparisons with other areas of science. So to take an example, we both think that classification in psychopathology is likely to be pretty complicated. Now I use John Dupre's promiscuous realist position to argue for that. Peter uses Nelson Goodman. But we could have argued from that directly from thinking about how classification works in the biological sciences more generally. And I think for lots of our claims, we could have done without the metaphysics and just kind of said, so if you ask the question, well, you know, would it be possible to have a decent classification that just employed functionally defined properties, then I think you could look at something like electronics, where that's what happens, to say, well, yeah, you know, that is kind of possible. So I think we could have got the conclusions by picking the right kind of comparisons, thinking about kind of empirically what seems to make sense, and have ditched all the metaphysical stuff. So that's the suggestion. Thank you.